We're studying in 2 Kings chapter 19, last Sunday morning we were looking at the promise that God gave for deliverance to Hezekiah and to all the people of Judah that were in the city of Jerusalem at this time when the Assyrians had come through the land of Judah and taken all their fenced cities and were there on the doorstep of Jerusalem. And King Sennacherib of Assyria had sent his servant Rabshakeh, who spoke those blasphemous words against the Lord and trying to discourage the hearts of God's people in Jerusalem, and telling them not to trust in God when King Hezekiah was encouraging them to do so, and that their God would not be able to deliver them any more than those gods of all those other nations that Assyria had conquered, as they were equating the God of heaven to be like one of those idols of those nations. And then Hezekiah had gone to the temple and had the answer from Isaiah the prophet that God was going to deliver them, and we saw that in verses 1-7 of 2 Kings chapter 19, and then in verses 8-13, the same words were written in a letter sent from Rabshakeh with the words from his master Sennacherib, king of Assyria. And that was in verses 8-13. And so the letter contained the same blasphemy that he had personally spoken in Hebrew at the wall of Jerusalem before. And so Hezekiah spread that letter out before the Lord in the temple in verses 14-19 and prayed that God would stand up for them for his name's sake. So then God answered in verses 20-34, repeating his promise of deliverance that he'd given before in verses 1-7. But with many more words, which we want to read that again. But before we reread verses 20-34, as we're reviewing this context, we read those words at the very end last week, so we want to look at that again as we start this morning. But before we do that, we do want to also refresh our memories for just a moment, going back to the book of Isaiah. As we know, the Lord had foretold these events with the coming of the Assyrians, and that they were going to flood through the land, that the Lord was going to use them as a razor to shave off all the hair, and he was going to bring them in like a flood of waters up to their neck. He was going to use them as a rod of his wrath and indignation. So he had used several different comparisons or metaphors and such to foretell what was going to come and the troubles they were going to have from the Assyrians. But when God foretold that, he also foretold that he would save them from the Assyrians, that he would turn the Assyrians back, and ultimately that he would bring destruction upon them. The Lord's condition was for Judah to trust in the Lord and not in other nations or themselves. So just to briefly revisit some of those verses where the Lord had promised this deliverance, going back to the days of Ahaz, Hezekiah's father. So this was not the first time when it's actually happening, when Hezekiah is praying to the Lord at the end of chapter 18, and then again here in chapter 19 with the letter that he spread out before the Lord in the temple. So it's not just at this time that God promises this deliverance. He had foretold it the generation before. So he's repeating his promise of deliverance, but Hezekiah was aware of all those words. It's through Isaiah, the same prophet who's physically with Hezekiah at this point, that the Lord is inspiring a repeat of his promise of deliverance through. So back in the book of Isaiah, in chapter 8, verses 7 through 13, he says, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over, he shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel." Well, now that's happened there in 2 Kings chapters 18 and 19. And then he said in verse 9, "Associate yourselves, O you people, and you shall be broken in pieces." So if they tried to join with others for their deliverance, they would be broken. He says, "And give ear, all ye of far countries. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand, for God is with us. For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, Say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom the people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread." So there's the Lord promised that deliverance here when he foretold how they were going to come against them, and how to the extent at which the Assyrians were going to afflict them as this flood of waters up to their neck. But he said that they were to, at this time, to sanctify the Lord and let him be your fear and let him be your dread. And that's exactly what Hezekiah is doing. In chapter 10, we also saw the Lord's promise that he would deliver them from the Assyrians. In verses 5 through 11, he referred to the Assyrian as the rod of his anger, and and the staff in their hand was the Lord's indignation, and even foretold the boastful words that they would use. In verse 8, he said, "For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings? Is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? As my hand has found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols?" And that's exactly what Sennacherib had said through Rabshakeh, first in the words that he spoke in Hebrew at the walls of Jerusalem, and then in the letter that was in that we saw in verses 8 through 13 of 2 Kings 19. So what God had foretold of the boasting of the Assyrians, that has been fulfilled. But this is where God promised once more that he would deliver them at that time. In verses 12 through 19, here in Isaiah 10, he says, "Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem..." So he had a purpose of inflicting punishment on them for the evils that they had done for all of those years in their with their idols and all of that wickedness, which they have repented of under Hezekiah and his leadership. They have, but they still had to partake of the punishment that God had reserved for them for all that wickedness. And so he said when he was finished with that, when the punishment was over, with that which he had spoken about in verse 5, the Assyrian being the rod of God's anger and the staff in their hand, his indignation, and how he was going to use them against Jerusalem to punish his people there. But when God finished that work, which he's now done here in Hezekiah's time, but he said when he finished that whole work, he says, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. So when after he was finished using the Assyrians to accomplish the purpose that he had to punish the wickedness of his own people, then what was he going to do with that rod that the Assyrians were in the hand of God? God had raised them up. God had used them to accomplish his purpose against Judah and Jerusalem, as he had used them to fulfill God's purposes in destroying the northern kingdom of Israel and those other nations around them. But when God was finished using the Assyrians for the purposes that he had, and here particularly he's referring to what he was going to use them to do against Jerusalem, then he was going to punish that fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. And so then in verse 13 he says, for he saith, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man, and my hand hath found a nest, and as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth. And there was none that moved the wing, or opened the mouth, or peeped. And we could see all that boasting in Rabshakeh's words. And so here's the pride of the Assyrians. Did they acknowledge in any way, did they believe, understand, or give any acknowledgement that they had been raised up by God himself? That this was the work of God, that they had the power that they did, and all that they had done was the Lord's work? Or did they take full credit for themselves? And, well, Sennacherib is doing that. So that's what God was going to punish then. So verse 15, he says, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself as if it were no wood. And so here God is plainly stating what the Assyrians actually are. I mean, they were just a tool in God's hand. Who fashioned the tool? I mean, tools are made and then used. Well, so were the Assyrians. They were made as a kingdom by God and then used by the same God who built them and raised them up to do everything that they had done. And for these boastful words to be coming forth from the king of Assyria, I mean, it would be the same if using a tool in your hand, if the tool started boasting against you when you were using it. It's foolishness, and that's what they were, that was what their pride was. So in verse 16 he says, therefore shall the Lord of hosts send among his fat ones leanness, and under him, under his glory, he shall kindle a burning fire, a burning like the burning of a fire, and the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his holy one for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and shall consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body. And they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth, and the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. So God is being very clear here about what he was going to do to Assyria when he was finished with his work in using them against his own people there at Jerusalem. Then he was going to, and it was going to be sudden, as he says, in one day. And that's exactly what's going to happen. So the Lord had already spoken about all of this through Isaiah the prophet, even a generation before, in Ahaz's time. And so these were words that obviously Isaiah knew, and it's very obvious that Hezekiah also knew these words. The question is, Was he going to believe those words? Was he going to trust the Lord? As the Lord had told the people there in chapter 8 when this time came. And he said, let me be your fear and your dread. Well, was Hezekiah going to do that? Or was Hezekiah going to disbelieve these words? No way that all this was of God, or that he was going to be able to take this mighty nation and so suddenly turn them away and deliver Jerusalem. So which was it going to be? Was he going to have a heart of faith or of unbelief? And we know the answer to that. He trusted the Lord fully. He believed all of those words and encouraged all of his people to believe these promises. So then when it's actually happening, and this is another good lesson, the Lord had promised this deliverance if they trusted him, and they're doing that. So the deliverance is going to come. Yet when it's happening, what does Hezekiah still do? When he went to the temple that first time after Rabshakeh had visited in person. And then what does he do again there after that letter's written, where he spreads the letter out before the Lord there in verses 14 through in 2 Kings chapter 19, verses 14 through 19. He still asks the Lord to do what he promised to do. Somebody might ask the question, well, if the Lord already promised to do it, he was going to do it, why does Hezekiah need to ask him to do what he's already said he's going to do? Well, there's a good lesson for us there. I mean, the Lord promises us many things. What is one of those great promises that we have that's in Matthew chapter 6, 24 through 34, that if we, and we all remember Matthew 6 and 33, what does he tell us that will happen if we seek first God's kingdom and righteousness? When he's telling us we don't need to take thought or care for our food, drink, and clothes, the necessities of life. He says, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And what's the promise? That if we do that, all these things will be added to us. Does God promise to provide the things that we need physically to live in this earth? If we will concentrate our minds and our efforts on seeking him and the eternal things, does God promise to take care of our physical needs? He does. Now, what do we say about that? Well, God's promised to do that, so as long as we're fulfilling what he says we have to do in seeking him, then we don't even need to really ask for that. Is that the right approach? And of course, it isn't. Because in that same chapter in Matthew 6, Jesus, in teaching his disciples, and us by extension, of course, how to pray, what did he teach? What did he teach us to pray? Give us this day what? Our daily bread. So God has promised to provide our physical needs if we'll seek first his kingdom and righteousness. Yet the Lord tells us to, teaches us to ask for what the Lord has promised. When we're asking the Lord to do what he's promised, I mean, what is one of the things that demonstrates from our hearts? Well, doesn't that demonstrate we believe his promise when we're going to ask him to do that? That's why in James chapter 1, when he says in verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, what does he say? Let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. So there's the promise from God. And again, there are conditions there, just like there are really for all of God's promises that he's made. There are conditions. There was for Hezekiah. They had to let the Lord be their fear and dread and not turn to any other source, whether it be themselves or to some other nation, any other source than the Lord for their deliverance when the Assyrians came against them. And so they had that condition to meet, that they would only have their trust and fear in the Lord. And So they were meeting that condition. Well, there's the condition we saw for the Lord to give us our daily bread, to add these physical necessities for our physical needs. We have to seek first His kingdom and righteousness. Well, there are conditions for receiving wisdom from God. But one of those conditions is right there, that we ask for it. The Lord teaches us to ask Him for the things that He has promised to us. And He said in verse 6, let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. Well, where does faith come from? Hearing, and hearing by the word of God, Romans 10:17. So that faith by which we are going to ask is rooted in God's word, where He's promised those things. So those are the things that we ask in faith without any wavering or doubt when He's promised it. So when we ask God for our daily bread, do we ask that with a heart of that wavers? Maybe He's going to feed me, maybe He's not. I mean, is that acceptable to Him? No. We have to have faith in His promises, but when we, in faith, nothing wavering, ask God to do what He's promised to do, that pleases Him. He teaches us to do that. That's exactly what Hezekiah is doing there in 2 Kings chapter 19. He knows that God has already promised this deliverance, and he's shown his trust in the Lord and encouraged all of his people to trust the Lord. And he's fully turning to the Lord at this time for his help and deliverance. And he's asking the Lord now, out of his faith in him, to fulfill what he's promised to do and grant that deliverance to them from the Assyrians. And God is going to hear this prayer, and he's going to fulfill his promise and deliver them. So back in 2 Kings chapter 19, verses 20 through 34, it says, then Isaiah the son of Amoz sent to Hezekiah, saying, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, that which thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. Now again, there's particular meaning to that phrase when God says, I've heard your prayer. It doesn't mean that he has merely heard the words, as in hearing the sound and knowing what Hezekiah had spoken. In that respect, what does any man say about anything at any time that God hasn't heard? I mean, God knows every thought and word and deed of everyone. That's not news for God to say that he's heard whatever it is that man has spoken. And that being true also of any words that we might pray to him. But there's a particular meaning to that when he says, I've heard your prayer. That, by the way God defines that, means that God has agreed to grant the request, the petition that is being asked in that prayer. Now, this is not I'm not making that up. I better not be. But that's what he says in 1 John chapter 5 in verse 14. And this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he heareth us. In verse 15, and if we know that he hear us, whatsoever we ask, we know that we have the petition that we desired of him. So when he speaks there of God hearing us, when we make our request known to him, that's how he defines what that means, that we receive from him that which we have made request for. And that's exactly what God is saying here in reply to Hezekiah, that he has heard his prayer. He is granting the request that's being made. He says, I've heard what you have prayed against Sennacherib, and he says, I have, when you've prayed against Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, I've heard that. Verse 21, this is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him. So this is the explanation of his hearing the prayer, that he's going to grant this request. Here's what God is going to do. So God is going to specify very plainly exactly what he's going to do. And so at the very beginning of the chapter 19, when Hezekiah went before the Lord in the temple, after Rabshakeh had spoken his blasphemous words there, at that time, the Lord answered him through Hezekiah and promised his deliverance. He said, and this was what Isaiah had said back in verses 6 and 7, thus shall you say to your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words which thou hast heard, and with which the servants of the king of Assyria hath blasphemed me. Behold, I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumor, and shall return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So God had again promised that deliverance. Well, now, after that, the letter comes, and Hezekiah spreads the letter out and prays to God again. This is what the Lord says. This is the word which the Lord hath spoken concerning him, concerning Sennacherib, king of Assyria, here in verse 21. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. Now, who are these words being directed to right here? Obviously, the Lord is directing these words to Sennacherib himself. And here's Sennacherib with all of this boasting and telling the people of Judah and Jerusalem not to trust the Lord, not to listen to King Hezekiah when he's telling them to trust the Lord. So he's saying in response that the virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and laughed you to scorn. So here you are boasting and saying, who are you and who's going to deliver you? And who's your God that you think he's going to deliver you? And God is answering, and my people are laughing and scorning you, Sennacherib. So this is a strong answer. He says, the daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel. So not some idol like these other nations have, but against the Holy One of Israel, against the God of heaven, the one that's been using this this king of Assyria as a tool in his hand. And so even though the axe is boasting itself against the one who's chopping with it and the one who's sawing with the saw, God is answering and saying, who have you reproached? It's me that you're boasting against. So verse 23, he says, by thy messengers thou hast reproached the Lord and hast said, with the multitude of my chariots I am come up to the height of the mountains, to the sides of Lebanon, and will cut down the tall cedar trees thereof and the choice fir trees thereof. And I will enter into the lodgings of his borders and into the forest of his Carmel. So when he's saying, I'm gonna stay here. Remember, he was telling all the people, "You're gonna have a great new home. We're gonna take you to a new land, and you can have your houses and gardens there." So they were fully boasting that they were just what they had done to the northern kingdom of Israel. They were gonna do now through the whole land and possess it. God is telling them that that is not going to happen. So when they're boasting about what they're going to do in this land, verse 24, he says, I have digged and drunk strange waters, and with the side of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of besieged places. So here's more of their boasting about what all they've done in conquering these other lands. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times that I have formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste fenced cities into ruinous heaps. So God is letting them know, when whatever you've done, I'm the one that's done that. This is my work using you to do it. And God had made them, and God had done all the work with them. Verse 26, therefore their inhabitants were of small power. This is why they couldn't stand before the Assyrians. It's not because the Assyrians themselves were so great. They had all their power from God. Therefore, their inhabitants were of small power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field and as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops, and as corn blasted before it be grown up. But I knew thy abode and thy going out and thy coming in and thy rage against me. So he says, you've done nothing of yourself. Everything that you've done that you're giving yourself credit for is my work. But I've known this, and I've known I know where you came from. You're going out and coming in and your rage against me. So here's what he says in verse 28. Because thy rage against me and thy tumult has come up into mine ears, therefore I will put my hook in thy nose and my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. Now when God is answering Hezekiah's prayer with these words through Isaiah the prophet, were these words only going to Hezekiah? Were they only going to the people of Jerusalem that the Assyrians were trying to discourage? Or were these words going to go back in answer to Sennacherib and the letter that he had sent through Rabshakeh? God is speaking back to the Assyrians. These words are going to go back to them. So when they're telling them, here's how, look at how great we are. Nobody can stand before us. You're not going to be able to, and your so-called God's not going to be able to save you any more than any of the others. And then the answer comes back, you're reproaching me, the God of heaven, and I'm the one that has used you to do everything that you've done, and now I'm going to put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips and turn you around and send you back where you came from. How would those words, had anybody spoken like that to Sennacherib before? It's rather doubtful that anybody had. And is this what he would be expecting in reply when he's poured through the land as he has already done? Or is he not expecting them to quake in fear and then give up and then agree to become captives? I mean, he's obviously got in mind that he's going to take Jerusalem without having to go through a lengthy siege like he had to do in Samaria. I mean, he would be willing to do that, no question, but he's looking to have them to give up and that be the end of this with no fight. But these words are coming back to him where God's saying, I'm going to put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips and turn you around and send you home. In verse 20, he says, and this shall be a sign unto thee. Ye shall eat this year such things as grow of themselves, and in the second year that which springeth of the same, and in the third year sow you and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruits thereof. And this was a promise from God in what he was going to do. So this land that the Assyrians had gone through, what are God's people going to be doing in that land that's full of the Assyrians right now? Were they going to be cultivating their own land again very soon? God's people would be. The Assyrians were going to be gone. I mean, that's God's making it very clear that all this is going to happen. It takes a while for, if you're planting all of these things, for all of it to produce adequately. That wasn't going to happen just in 1 year. I mean, these Assyrians have come through the land. They're confined here in Jerusalem. So they were going to be able to eat of that year of what was growing of itself and then what that produced again the following year. But by year three, they're going to be eating of all of their own plantings. So God's letting his people know that they're going to be sent home right now very quickly, and then this land is going to be yours again. So verse 30 says, and the remnant that has escaped of the house of Judah shall yet again take root downward and bear fruit upward. So he's promising these blessings here on his people when he delivers them from the Assyrians. And he says, for out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of the Lord of hosts shall do this. Therefore, thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shield, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. So that's the end of what God says in answer to that. So he has some particular words for the Assyrians themselves, and then finishes with some very encouraging words for his own people there in Jerusalem. The Assyrians were not going to enter Jerusalem. And God said they weren't even going to shoot an arrow into there. So if they are afraid that the Assyrians are going to all come as a mass against the city and fight against it, the Lord is telling them, no, not one of their arrows is going to be shot in here. They're not going to come in here. Their arrows aren't even going to go in there. Not only that, the Lord said they're not going to set up a bank again. There's not going to be a siege. They're not going to be there to besiege it. They're not going to assault the city. They're not going to fight against it. It's not going to be conquered. So if there's going to be no siege, no battle, and no Assyrians in there or any part of them, then I mean, how complete is this deliverance going to be from the Lord? And how fast? Well, like he'd said back in Isaiah before that we were reading in verse 10, the Lord said he was going to do this in one day. And so we can see how the Lord is promising a full deliverance from the Assyrians here. And it's going to happen completely and suddenly. And it does. So the last three verses of the chapter, 35 through 37, he's going to show how it was fulfilled. Verse 34, though, the Lord told them why he was going to do it. And Hezekiah had asked the Lord to do that to make his name great, which he was going to do. So he was going to do it for his own name's sake, because everybody was going to know about this throughout the world. But he also noted that he was going to do this for his servant David's sake. This was the city of David. Was God still mindful of David and the promises that God, the righteous life that David led, and the promises that God gave to David because of that, and what he was going to do for his kingdom and for Jerusalem, in spite of all of the wickedness that's gone on? And we've seen since Solomon's time, when we look at the periods of righteousness that have existed in the land of Judah, because it's now been 200, well, it was 208 years to the fall of Samaria, and so it's now, five, 6 years later. So, I mean, it's right around 214, 215 years since Solomon's death, a little over two centuries. And in this 215-year, roughly, period of time, since Solomon died, the son of David, how much of that time have the people there in Judah and Jerusalem been walking after the Lord's commandments faithfully? It's been a minority, a very clear minority of that period of time. I mean, it would be under the reign of Asa and Jehoshaphat, and that's it, other than some sporadic 3 years the first 3 years of Rehoboam's reign, the early parts of the reigns of several of the kings, that period of time when Jehoiada the high priest was really ruling as the regent, when Joash was a boy, and then after he came of age, but followed the Lord under Jehoiada's guidance. I mean, we've had these periods where there were some righteous ones that led the people, but that's been the minority of the time. So in spite of the many years of wickedness and all of the rebellion against the Lord's commandments that have been demonstrated by the people, and the Lord was, of course, that was those sporadic periods of righteousness and Judah and Jerusalem, that excelled or exceeded what was in the northern kingdom where there was none. The Lord showed long suffering for all of that time for his people of those 10 tribes in the north. But finally, they have fallen to these Assyrians. But God's not letting that happen to Judah and Jerusalem. But a part of that reason, he gives two main reasons there. God was doing this for his own name's sake. Was there going to come a time when that wasn't going to be enough to save Jerusalem? Yeah, under the Babylonians. That was going to be another 130 years or so into the future. There was going to come a time when that wasn't going to be enough for God to save the city, or for the other reason either, for David's sake. But these are the two reasons he gives now. So God has been very long-suffering, and he's intentionally tried to demonstrate to all these other nations who he is, and that he is, that the God of Israel is not some idol. And that's been rather difficult when the people of his own people have turned to idols so much of the time through these years. God is also doing this for David's sake. So he's still so mindful of this man that was after God's own heart, that over 200 years, well over 200 years now after, this is going to be somewhere around 250 years after David's death, God is still speaking about David and what he's doing for David's sake. So that should tell us a lot about the Lord's thoughts about David, but also his faithfulness to his promises that he made to him. So we can understand why he made those promises to David. And we see that David has been the measuring stick. I mean, in the last chapter, at the beginning of chapter 18, the ones that are singled out, those rare ones that are righteous, that the Lord talks about, he'll say that they served, did what was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked after whose ways, in whose steps, all of their days? David's. I mean, he'll use that as the measuring stick for all these other ones. So we saw that in the previous chapter. But there again, God was mindful of David and his promises to him when he's going to save his city, the city of David, from these Assyrians. All right, so it happens, verses 35 to 37. What would Sennacherib have thought of that response? It doesn't take much imagination to consider what he would have thought about the reply that came to his letter. But in verse 35, he didn't have a whole lot of time to ponder that, did he? Because it happened. It says, "It came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they rose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses." So that reply would have been sent out there that day to the king of Assyria. And then when does, just like God promised his people he was going to save them, and how long was the did it take for the Lord to do it? It says he did it that night. So consider that here. I mean, they're getting that. The Assyrians are there, encamped in their land, sending them this letter with all this blasphemy there, and then the Lord says, "You don't need to be afraid of them. I'm going to get rid of them, and they're not going to set a foot in here. They're shooting an arrow in here. They're not going to besiege this place. They're going to go back to their own land." And then he does it that night, and look at how he did it. He sent an angel into their camp. Now, this shows how great and powerful and mighty these Assyrians are. As they're saying, "Who can stand before me? And what's your God going to do to deliver you?" Well, here's what he did. None of those other idols that they were talking about did anything like this, because they didn't exist. But this was the God of heaven they were reproaching, and God shows that. And this shows how God is different from any other being. What could he do? He sends one angel in and strikes dead 185,000 of their soldiers that night. And then, I mean, the next morning, whoever lives, what would you do if you're in the army? this mighty army, you're in the most powerful army in the world. And then you wake up suddenly one morning and 185,000 of your fellow soldiers are all dead in the camp. I mean, what in the world would you think? Well, what they thought, it's time to go. And they went. So it says in verse 36, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt in Nineveh. So he went back to his capital, just like God. So did God put a hook in his nose and a bridle on his lips and turn him around and send him back? He sure did. And by the way, when we look at this, he says, an angel of the Lord. How many angels did it take to strike dead 185,000 men in one night, suddenly like that? And then when Jesus told Peter, when he drew his sword and struck off the right ear of Malchus, the servant of the high priest in the Garden of Gethsemane, that night he was, in which he was betrayed, and he told him to put that up, and he says, do you not know that he could call on to his father and he would send him more than 12 legions of angels? Well, think about that. Look at what one angel could do. What if Jesus had asked for 12 legions of angels to come, what would any of those people that were doing any of those things that were to Jesus, that they were going to do to him that night? And there they are, blindfolding him and hitting him. Prophesy, which one of us hit you? And spitting on him and mocking him, and then putting him in that robe and putting a crown of thorns on his head, and the scourging and the crucifixion. They're wagging their heads and blaspheming him, and come down from the cross if you're God's son, if he'll have you. I mean, all these blasphemous words. And all he had to do was say the word, and what could have happened? What would any of those men have done? I mean, they could have been wiped out instantly. I mean, he could have in an instant showed all of them, yes, I am God's son, but they could have never done one of those things against him, and he could have wiped them all out in a moment. But of course he didn't, because that was not the Father's will. But could he have? Look at what power was at his disposal. I mean, all he had to do is look there and see what one angel did. I mean, there was no man can stand before the Lord. And these sure could not. So here's this mighty Assyrian empire, and how mighty are they to God? Whatever might they had was from God. And God showed them how weak they were and how small they were, and how the only thing they had done was whatever he had used them to do. And he turns them right around and sends them back home. I mean, they've got no courage to stay there in the land of Israel with 185,000 of their soldiers dead suddenly. Then what happens? Well, what did God say he was going to do to the king of Assyria when he sent him back? Well, he told him that he was going to send a blast upon him, and he would hear a rumor and will return to his own land. And he says, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. That's what God said back in verse 7 of this chapter. So what happens in verse 37? What happens when he gets back home to Nineveh? And it came to pass, as he was worshiping the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sherezer, his sons, smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. Did what God promised in verse 7, that when he went back to his own land, he was going to fall by the sword? Did that happen? Yes. At the hand of two of his own sons, and another son is the one that becomes the next ruler as king of Assyria, but Sennacherib dies. And where does he die? In the house of his so-called god. So while he's worshiping this false idol, so look at the demonstration God is making here when he's blasting against the God of heaven and equated him with an idol, and God shows him his power and that he's no idol, that he is the one and only true and living God, the creator of all things, and the one that's given him all of his power, sends him back to his land, just like he says. And then when he's worshiping one of these false gods, is Nisroch able to in the act of his worship of Nisroch, is this Nisroch able to save him from his own sons? No, because Nisroch was an imagination of man. He was invented by man. He doesn't exist. He's not real. And he couldn't do a thing. And so here his own sons kill him while he's worshiping this idol. So if you look at exactly what God did to Sennacherib and how he did it, from the way he sent him back to Assyria and then what he did to him there when he was back in Nineveh, the Lord beholds all that are proud and abases him. And how much more could Sennacherib have been abased than what happened to him there? All right, well, we're finished with chapter 19, and we're also finished with our time this morning. So we'll go to our Heavenly Father in prayer as we close.